TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. The U.S.-Israel Special Relationship. Three former high-level CIA employees were the speakers on the last panel of the one-day summit at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. The date was March 7, 2014. It was the most high-profile response and critique to date to an annual conference by AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. AIPAC's mission, from their website, is to, quote, urge all members of Congress to support Israel through foreign aid, government partnerships, and joint anti-terrorism efforts. Paul Pilar, Ray McGovern, and Philip Giraldi addressed the question, is Israel really a U.S. ally? Paul Pilar retired in 2005 from a 28-year career in the CIA. His last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He studied at Oxford and Princeton and is now a senior fellow at Georgetown University's Center for Security Studies. Here's Professor Pilar on the topic, are threats to Israel's security inflated to justify occupation and U.S. support?
Let's consider the question of what is an ally. At a minimum, I'd say it involves a certain coincidence or congruence of interest between two countries. But more than that, it implies that the relationship itself has positive value in that one country is willing to do certain things that it would not otherwise have done on its own because the alliance exists and because the other country would like it to do that, with the implied quid pro quo that the other country is going to do some things it wouldn't otherwise do in favor of the interests of the first state. Mutual assistance. Now, if you look at the U.S.-Israeli relationship, with regard to coincidence of interest, there clearly are some interests that we have in common with regard to our domestic social and political structure. And we do have some shared concerns with our Israeli friends with certain forms of violent extremism that consider both of us as enemies. But the coincidence runs into some limitations. With regard to the internal political and social structure, the whole concept of a state being defined in terms of a particular dominant religion or ethnic group is, of course, foreign to the way we look at things here in the United States. And as far as having common adversaries is concerned, some of the aspects of the Israeli approach for dealing with them are not ones that we would share and not ones in U.S. interest. For example, it is not in U.S. interests to have had a strangulating blockade of the Gaza Strip as a way of dealing with Hamas, which Israel considers a sworn enemy of itself, not to mention things like Operation Cast Lead and what that has done in the Strip. And if you consider as one of the major objectives of the current Israeli government, the continued control of the West Bank, as it clearly is, that also is something that is not in U.S. interests and has little to do with fending off the violent adversaries that we may share. So I think we have to look at that other aspect of alliances, the mutual assistance, what each side does for the other that they would not otherwise do. Certainly in one direction, that is to say what the United States does that it would not otherwise do on Israel's behalf, there's an awful lot. And we can start with the approximately $3.1 billion in assistance each year. Let's just review some of the bidding. The total amount of U.S. aid provided to Israel through the years is $118 billion in uncorrected or unadjusted dollars, or adjusting for inflation, approximately $234 billion, or about a little more than a quarter of a trillion. This is going to a country, the recipient country, that has a per capita income of about $33,000 a year, which makes Israel one of the 25 richest countries in the world. That is a higher average income level than for the European Union as a whole. As far as military strength is concerned, which is something we would immediately turn to when we talk about security issues, There's no question that Israel is the preeminent military power in the region. We are all aware of its nuclear arsenal, but at the conventional level, the qualitative edge that the Israelis have enjoyed and has accounted for their splendid victories in the past has, if anything, grown greater as Arab armies and their equipment have rusted, which I think is the appropriate description of something like the Egyptian army. So if there were a new military contest between Israel and any of its neighbors, it would be, quite frankly, no contest. Now, this kind of aid has all kinds of opportunity costs for us American taxpayers. Besides reducing the debt, which we always hear about, let me just throw out a couple of approximate equivalent opportunity costs that we could do with that $3.1 billion annually. For example, that dispute we had a couple of weeks ago about the military pension cost of living thing that almost brought us again to another debt ceiling crisis, this money would pay for that, the money involved, five times over each year. Or for those of you who don't like the military stuff, we could put 400,000 more American children in the Head Start, or thinking about that infamously crumbling infrastructure we've got, probably repair an average of over 3,000 of the more than 140,000 bridges that are deemed to be in need of repair in this country. Well, you get the point. And then, of course, beyond the material assistance, there are all the lonely votes in the United Nations and other providing of political cover to Israel whenever its activities or policies have become the subject of international condemnation. And this is certainly something the United States would not have done were it not for the alliance, or its half of the alliance, and they have resulted in substantial political and diplomatic costs for the United States. You look in the other direction of what assistance is being provided from Israel to the U.S., and it becomes far harder. In fact, it's hard to find much of anything at all that the ally would not otherwise be doing on its own behalf anyway. One sometimes hears references to things like science and technology cooperation, especially with regard to military technology, and clearly we have had that with the Israelis, but almost all of this is either things that Israel would be doing on its own because it's in its own interest to do it, with the United States not necessarily a factor, or it's something where the cooperation could take place and probably would take place without the extraordinary nature of the relationship that results in all of the material and diplomatic support going the other way. The traditional kind of thing that we think of, first of all, when we think of allies in the security context, Americans have fought alongside our allies from Britain and Canada and the World Wars and that sort of thing. And here we don't get any benefit at all. It's been less damaging for the United States for Israel to stay out of our fights. And this was dramatically demonstrated in, for example, Operation Desert Storm back in 1991 when we made it absolutely clear we don't want the Israelis to get involved in that fight because it would be more politically damaging for us if they did. And that underscores the extent to which the relationship on security matters has been more of a liability than an asset. I think the probably the principal set of liabilities is the extremist and terrorist reaction to what is widely seen, not just by extremists and terrorists, as the United States being the chief patron and facilitator of Israeli behavior and policies that are subjects of hatred and controversy, specifically the continued occupation of Palestinian land, and such uses of force as Operation Cast Lead in the Gaza Strip. General Petraeus, a couple of years ago, made a statement about this when he was still wearing the uniform, I think before he became the CIA director, which he quite pointedly expressed the judgment, with which I agree, that the United States has been paying a substantial price because of this particular association with the policies of another state, and that the price we see comes up in, say, interrogations of captured terrorists or would-be terrorists when they are describing their motives. The one theme that comes up again and again and again and again is the unresolved Palestinian issue, the Israeli role in it, and the U.S. role in backing Israel. But the concept that Israel is an ally of the United States is, of course, firmly embedded in American political discourse, and this enables the government of Israel to use the relationship in another way that doesn't always benefit and more often is detrimental to U.S. interests. The security of one's ally, after all, is supposed to be a concern of oneself. That, again, goes back to the basic concept of an alliance. And so anytime the label of Israeli security gets applied to something, then the U.S. is induced to follow certain paths that it might not otherwise follow and might not be in its interest. For example, in all the discussions about the West Bank and what might be done about that, we hear the Israeli demand, among many others, of course, to maintain a military presence indefinitely in the Jordan Valley, with the rationale being that it has to be a form of protection against some sort of unspecified threats coming from the east. And if you start thinking that through and asking yourself, well, just what is the threat that would come from the east? You know, is King Abdullah in Jordan going to fire up his old tanks and go across? You know, are the Iraqis going to go across Jordan? And are the Iranians going to go across Iraq and Jordan to, you know, launch some kind of invasion? Well, it's fanciful and, quite frankly, a bit ludicrous. Any Arab legion that started wading across the Jordan River would be crushed before it had a chance to dry its feet, even if the Israelis were not in occupation of the West Bank. Now, something somewhat similar is happening with a very salient issue today, and that's the Iranian nuclear question. Now, there is no doubt that there is a lot of genuine concern in Israel, and I'm talking about the population, not just about the government, about the specter of an Iranian nuclear weapon. But if that were the only motivation here, then the government of Israel would be supporting the current negotiating effort, which is clearly the best chance that the world has had in the last 30 years to cap and control the Iranian nuclear program in a way that would give us the assurance that it's going to stay peaceful. Just look at what was achieved with the preliminary agreement, the so-called joint plan of action that was negotiated with the Iranians and completed last November. That alone, even if it were just extended indefinitely, got most of what we need to get in terms of enhanced inspections, in terms of putting a cap on the low-enriched uranium, in terms of doing away with the medium-enriched uranium, having restrictions on any further advances that mean anything at their nuclear reactor, and so on and so forth. And yet the government of Israel, far from supporting these negotiations, has been doing everything it can to sabotage and undermine them, including promoting legislation in this country that would have that effect. And so one has to conclude that the Israeli policy here is not driven just by a concern about an Iranian nuke. It's driven by other objectives. The main objective, as I would describe it, is to keep in play the issue of a possible Iranian nuclear weapon, because that immediately can be translated into Israeli security. Now, never mind that, you know, if, contrary to the current policy, Iran ever were to build a nuke, this would be one nuke against the 200 or however it is that Israel has. We still are within reach very much of that objective of securing an agreement that gives us confidence that there never will be an Iranian nuke. And yet, probably the single overriding theme in national and foreign and security policy that the current Israeli government has propounded is the anti-Iranian theme. And if you listen to the Israeli Prime Minister's speech that he gave a few blocks away at the convention center earlier this week, the first half of the speech was all about how awful Iran is. Let me just mention a couple of things that the Prime Minister said, because he really has been straining to make the case. I mean, he refers to the Iranian nuclear weapons program. Well, according to the U.S. intelligence community, Iran has not decided to build a nuclear weapon, and any of their weapons design work was ended over a decade ago. He also said that Iran publicly calls for the destruction of Israel. I'm pretty familiar with Iranian public government statements, and I have a hard time finding anything. There was one thing that the former president, Ahmadinejad, said a few years ago that got mistranslated into, you're wiping Israel off the map or something like that. If you ask the current Iranian government what their perspective on this is, well, the Iranian foreign minister, Mr. Zarif, said if the Palestinian issue can be resolved, he foresees actually having full diplomatic relations between the Iranians and the Israelis. I'm not predicting that's going to happen anytime soon, but it certainly shows you how far from the truth is any statement that Iran publicly calls for Israel's destruction. And then the prime minister said, as another example, Iran continues to build ICBMs. I don't know how to put this, but the most charitable way is that's flat-rate false. Insofar as anything we know, there's no indication they're doing anything with ICBMs or even IRBMs, the next lower range. They do have medium-range ballistic missiles, but even on those, they haven't been doing much in the way of testing or development so far. So what does this constant drumbeat of this Iranian specter do for Mr. Netanyahu's government? Well, it serves as the best kind of distraction you possibly could have from things that the Prime Minister perhaps would rather not talk about, some of which have been the subject of earlier presentations here today, such as the occupation. It keeps Iran ostracized, it keeps it as an international pariah, and therefore is not going to be a competitor for influence with Israel in the Middle East. And in particular, it precludes any competition for U.S. attention as a partner in things where we might want to work with other governments, and not just with the Israelis in this region, to advance our interests. And however much Iran may still be an adversary in other respects, the fact is we actually have some parallel interests with them with regard to things like stability in Afghanistan, where some of you may recall there was a brief window back in 2000 and 2001 in which we were actually working closely, our diplomats and Iranian diplomats, to bring about political change and transition and the installation of the Karzai government in Afghanistan. That lasted for just a few months before our president declared the axis of evil. And members of the neocon persuasion told Iran, take a number. We're getting Iraq first. We'll get you next. All of this runs very much counter to the U.S. interests, both with regard to complicating the effort to get that agreement to make sure that the Iranian nuclear program stays peaceful, and also by constraining U.S. diplomacy throughout the region and preventing us from doing things like talking to the Iranians about how to keep Afghanistan stable. My concluding thought about all this is that not just with regard to the U.S.-Israeli relationship, but indeed our relationship with any other country, ones that we might call allies or ones that we might call adversaries, that it would be better just to forget about those labels and look at specific interests and where a particular country can help us and where it doesn't help us with regard to things that are important to us. And U.S. foreign policy and national security would be much better served if we did that. Thank you very much.
That was Professor Paul Pilar, 28-year veteran with the CIA. He was executive assistant to Director of Central Intelligence William Webster. He returned to academia after his retirement in 2005. The next speaker was Ray McGovern, the retired CIA officer turned political activist. In his 27 years with the CIA, McGovern chaired national intelligence estimates and prepared the president's daily brief. When he retired, he received the Intelligence Commendation Medal. He returned it in 2006 in protest at the CIA's involvement in torture. In his talk at the National Summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship, McGovern told moving as well as funny anecdotes that I recommend you hear or read on the website natsummit.org. For now, here are only two. The reference to the fact that Israel has never defined its eastern border towards the West Bank, Jordan, and beyond. The other is the well-known joke about Israel becoming the 51st state. Israel usually gets unanimous support within the Senate for pro-Israel legislation and resolutions. Here's Ray McGovern.
Is Israel really a U.S. ally? An ally is a country with whom your country has a mutual defense treaty. Oh, wow. Is that too literal? Well, I was speaking to a bunch of Congress people, and I said, hey, these are lawmakers. They should probably know that Israel is not our ally. And for them to keep talking about, oh, our ally, Israel, our ally, juridically speaking, without a mutual defense treaty, that's not quite right. Okay? Now, that's the first point. The other point is simply that after the 1973 war, where the Arabs did attack Israel, There are all kinds of plans as to how to prevent this from happening again. And some of my former colleagues were involved in taking soundings among high Arab leaders and so forth. And the idea was, hey, maybe we'll offer Israel a mutual defense treaty, and then, you know, nobody try that again. So we broached it to the Israelis. So it's not widely known. And the Israelis said, well, you know, that's really sweet. Thank you very much, but no thanks. Now, why do you suppose a country would turn down a mutual defense treaty with the strongest nation in the world? Well, treaties require mutually internationally recognized borders. Huh? You know, and that's kind of sticky wicket there, you know? The other thing is the treaties usually require, as Paul said, you know, sort of a modicum of sharing of information. If you're going to attack another country, you should really let your ally know, well, by the way, next week we're going to attack Syria, or next week we're going to, you know. And the Israelis didn't want to, you know, didn't want to bother with that, because it's far easier for them, in their view, to ask for forgiveness rather than permission. You probably have heard the old saw that some people wanted to make Israel the 51st state. And Likud objected vehemently, saying, no, that would mean we'd only have two senators.
That was Ray McGovern. He was a CIA analyst from 1963 to 1990. The last speaker on the panel with the topic, Is Israel Really a U.S. Ally?, was Philip Giraldi. He's a former counterterrorism specialist and military intelligence officer who worked for 18 years for the CIA in Turkey, Italy, Germany, and Spain. He may be the most high-profile ex-CIA person on the panel, having appeared on Good Morning America, MSNBC, NPR, the BBC, Fox News, Al Jazeera, 60 Minutes, and many more. Here's an excerpt of his much longer speech.
I would like to go a bit beyond the comments that both of my colleagues have made and suggest not only that Israel is no ally, but also that it is actually not a friend, because it does actual damage to the United States through using its considerable access to Congress and the media to promote policies that are good neither for the United States nor for Israel. Israel might or might not have been an actual enabler of the disastrous American invasion of Iraq, but it is undeniably true that American officials extremely close to the Israeli government were behind the rush to war and the forgery of phony intelligence that fed the process. If the United States goes to war with Iran in the near future, it will not be because Tehran actually threatens America. It will be because Israel and its powerful lobby in the U.S. have succeeded in creating an essentially false casus belli to mandate such action. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who once commented that 9/11 was good for Israel, has repeatedly sought to commit our government to draw red lines that would narrow options for the White House and de facto require it to take action with the military against Iran. Congress is meanwhile advancing legislation that would commit the United States to intervene militarily in support of a unilateral Israeli attack, meaning that Israel could easily be empowered to make the decision on whether or not the U.S. goes to war. Nothing relating to Israel is quite like the U.S. interaction with other countries. Delinda and Janet have outlined the dollar costs and special financing arrangements that go to support Israel, measures that are not in place for any other nation. Congress also approved on Wednesday, as part of the United States-Israel Strategic Partnership Act, by a vote of 410-1, an Israeli exemption from the reciprocity mandated by the so-called visa waiver program. Israelis will be able to travel freely to the United States, while their government will be allowed to refuse entry to American citizens. This is a privilege that is granted to no other country. One congressman has recently even introduced a bill to cut off federal funding for any academic organization that engages in boycotting Israel. Boycotting other countries is okay. Israel interferes in American elections, most recently on behalf of Mitt Romney. It has corrupted our Congress. Its head of government publicly rebukes our own head of state. And its intelligence officers actually provide alarmist and inaccurate private briefings for American senators on Capitol Hill. I also would not doubt that Israel, accustomed to behaving with impunity towards its alleged friend and patron in Washington, might manufacture a pretext to draw the U.S. into a new conflict, something reminiscent of the Lavan affair in Alexandria, Egypt in 1954, or the false flag attack on the USS Liberty in 1967. Israel currently strongly supports using force to intervene in Syria, a proposition that is opposed overwhelmingly by the American public. In short, Israel has no reluctance to use its enormous political and media clout in the U.S. to pressure successive administrations to conform to its own foreign and security policy views. One other very good reason why Israel should not receive billions of dollars in military assistance annually is its persistent espionage against the United States. Grant Smith has described how Friends of Israel stole enriched uranium from a Pennsylvania refinery to create a nuclear arsenal. More recently, we have learned how Arnon Milchan, a Hollywood producer born in Israel, arranged for the illegal purchase of 800 nuclear triggers. Milchan picked up an Oscar last Sunday without any interference from the FBI. So the answer to the question, is Israel an ally of the United States, is most definitely no. Is it even a friend? Well, I suppose there are all kinds of friends in the world, but if you judge Israel by its record on how it interacts with the American government and people, I think the answer would also have to be no. Thank you.
That was Philip Giraldi, former military intelligence officer for the CIA and now executive director of the Council for the National Interest. That's a group that advocates for more even-handed policies by the U.S. government in the Middle East. This was the last of a four-part series of reports from the National Summit to reassess the U.S.-Israel special relationship. It was held March 7, 2014, at the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. For all speeches of that day in video, audio, or transcript, go to the website of the National Summit at natsummit.org. That's natsummit.org. This link is also listed in the newest programs section of TUC Radio's webpage, tucradio.org. If you want to hear this program again or subscribe to weekly free podcasts, go to the same page, newest programs, at tucradio.org. TUC Radio's free to all radio stations and free as podcast online. This is an unfunded program that depends entirely on donations by listeners. You can contact TUC Radio online at tucradio.org. The email is tuc@tucradio.org. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening.